Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon. My name is Lauren Litton, and I'm the host of Spotlight on Youth, a radio show dedicated to social and legal trends impacting the rights and well-being of children across the country. Spotlight on Youth is a project of the Children's Law Center, Inc., a not-for-profit children's rights legal services organization. The show is being streamed live over the Internet and will be available on demand after its conclusion. We encourage you to participate by asking our guests questions live on air by dialing 347-994-1149. That's 347-994-1149. And to indicate you have a question, you're going to press the number 1 on your telephone keypad and you'll be placed in a queue. Also, feel free to log into the chat room and pose a question there. For a while now, juvenile justice experts have suggested that using risk assessment tools can reduce recidivism. They can help create treatment and case plans for youth by matching a child's specific risks and needs to services that he or she will be most responsive to. Some of the risks that may be assessed include a youth's connection to a supportive network of adults and peers, his or her school performance, any behavioral issues, or antisocial attitudes. Today's guests are going to discuss risk assessments, their role in assisting youth achieve their full potential, and considerations for communities that are looking to standardize their use. Joining us for this discussion are Beth Fritz, who is currently the Chief Juvenile Probation Officer in Lehigh County, Pennsylvania. She is also a member of the Pennsylvania's Juvenile Justice System Enhancement Strategy Leadership Team, where she assists in training and facilitates the use of evidence-based practices within juvenile probation departments. Beth serves on many state community committees, including the Executive Committee of the Pennsylvania Council of Chief Juvenile Probation Officers. She co-chairs the Assessment Case Planning Committee, which has assisted in the training and implementation of the Youth Level of Service Case Management Inventory, known as the YLS-CMI Risk Assessment Tool. Additionally, Beth has provided oversight in the development of the Commonwealth's first standardized case plan. She earned a bachelor's in criminal justice from Kutztown University and a master's in administration of justice from Shippensburg University. Our second guest is Marianne Scully, who is the Deputy Director of the National Juvenile Defender Center. She has been with NJDC since 2000 and has worked on juvenile indigent defense issues for over 15 years. As Deputy Director, she oversees the delivery of juvenile defense training, facilitates and writes state assessments of juvenile indigent defense services, coordinates and participates in numerous cross-disciplinary reform efforts, and manages a variety of projects. Previously, Marianne has worked as a social worker and an attorney in Baltimore City, Maryland. She was also a teacher in both Pune, Micronesia and Nanuki, Kenya, and worked for a year at the Jesuit Refugee Service in Rome. Marianne earned her JD and MSW from Loyola University Chicago, where she was a Civitas Child Law Scholar and co-founder of the Public Interest Law Reporter. Gina Vincent also joins us. She is an associate professor in the Department of Psychiatry at the University of Massachusetts Medical School in Worcester, Massachusetts. Gina is a co-director of the National Youth Screening and Assessment Project, a technical assistance center for assisting juvenile justice agencies with the selection and implementation of mental health and risk assessments. She consults with juvenile justice agencies around the use and implementation of risk assessments for violence, reoffending, and case planning. Gina was awarded a Young Investigators Award from the National Institute on Drug Abuse and has presented on more than 100 occasions both internationally and nationally on juvenile justice-related topics. She is also a co-author of the publication we're highlighting today, and that's called The Risk Assessment in Juvenile Justice, a Guidebook for Implementation. So I'd like to welcome all of you to the show.
Thank you.
Thank you
so much, Lauren.
So, Gina, let's talk about the guidebook a little bit. And also, as I mentioned, the use of risk assessments is not a new concept. This guidebook was published, though, in November 2012. So why publish it now?
Right. That's an excellent question because you're right. Risk assessments have been around for a long time. People are pretty much familiar with the term at this point. But there's a couple reasons why we decided that we needed a guidebook now. And actually, Marianne and Beth are some of the people who really influenced this getting off the ground, because they were saying, we need a guidebook, we need a guidebook. And basically, one reason is that in the adult system, we've had risk assessment for a long time. And so they've gotten pretty comfortable since the tools have been around. They've gotten pretty comfortable at how to implement them and how to implement them fairly well. But when it comes to the juvenile justice system, it's only been for the last 10 years, roughly, that we've even had well-validated risk assessment tools on the market for use with youth. And so it's still a newer concept when we're dealing with juvenile justice, and these tools just haven't been around long enough for people to really have figured out how to get them in place well to use them in their decision making. The second reason is that as part of the Models for Change initiative, which has been funded by the MacArthur Foundation, which is a nationwide initiative in juvenile justice reform, we discovered that we were going around and helping these juvenile justice agencies with their assessment practices, and we noticed that some of them had risk assessment tools in place, but they had trained the probation officers how to complete the tool, and that is about it. And then it just sat in a kid's file sort of collecting dust, and it wasn't being used for anything. And we heard from people about how frustrated they were that they had to spend all this time completing an assessment tool that they're not even using in their decisions. And that's really where the implementation protocol comes in. And so we convened a group of experts, some of them being scholars in risk assessment, as we call them, some of them being a whole panel of defenders, prosecutors, and judges, which were put together by Marianne Scally, who's on the call. And then others were advisory group members who are practitioners in the field, like Beth, who was on our advisory group, who have actually, you know, dealt with the challenges of implementing risk assessment tools. And we all sort of sat together in various meetings and decided, based on what the research says and based on what our experiences are, what are the best practices that we can offer to the field, and thought that that should just be highlighted in a how-to guide, which we've developed that has 8 steps for implementation.
This is Marianne. I'm going to jump in, Gina. From the defender's perspective, you know, what we're hearing across the country is that tools that were being implemented, the defenders, as well as judges and prosecutors, just didn't have any idea what the tools were, what they were supposed to do, how they were supposed to be used. And we felt like there was, and I think there still is, a lot of confusion in the juvenile community about why we have these tools and what they're supposed to do, and what the proper implementation is supposed to look like, because it really wasn't clear to us before we started working with Gina and her crew and others. Really, what was the appropriate use of these tools?
Yeah, this is Beth. Just to add to what Jean and Marianne said, and to support what they said, I think for us, you know, there's renewed attention, and that's a good thing in the juvenile system regarding the use of such solid, validated instruments. But obviously, with implementing any kind of instrument or implementing anything, everyone's at a different stage. And so from a state perspective, looking to roll this out statewide, various counties are at different stages or phases. And this guide really allows these agencies to have a valuable resource for reference and to support their ongoing efforts in training when they have staff turnover and so forth. And I think the other thing is that it allows us to start talking the same language when we're training in the same consistent, structured way and using the guide as one of those resources. The other thing the guide does is it allows the professionals in our system who are working with youth to really understand, it makes references to what the research and the evidence indicates is most effective when working with these kids. And so it allows you to develop a very deliberate, intentional approach to not only how to do the assessment, but taking that into the case plan stage. And the guide puts all those pieces nicely together.
Terrific. And I know we're going to spend some time really even talking about risk assessment tools themselves, and but just staying on the guide for a little bit longer, one of the things in the guide is that it's framed by 7 guiding principles, which I think also helps actually guide this entire conversation. So can you sort of tell us what those guiding principles are and why were they important?
Sure. This is Gina. I'll jump in there. And before I go into the guiding principles, which are primarily research-based, I should probably just mention what a risk assessment is and offer a definition. But what we mean by risk assessment here is a risk for reoffending assessment tool. So that's an instrument that's developed to help answer the question, is this youth at relatively low or relatively high risk for reoffending specifically, be it violent reoffending or other types of serious reoffending? And with that in mind, because we need to know what risk is before we get into the principles, I'll just cover a few of them rather than take up all our time with these. But one guiding principle is that simply selecting and adopting a risk assessment tool in and of itself is not going to accomplish the desired objective unless it is implemented properly. So we've seen people adopt risk assessments. They train their staff how to do them. And if it's not put into their decision-making in a structured manner, nothing is going to change in the way that they're handling youth. So it's not going to change placement rates, it's not going to change supervision level, and it's not going to guide case planning if it's not implemented well. Another guiding principle was that the concepts of youth development must be considered in the implementation of any kind of assessment tool or case management approach in juvenile justice. We're very aware of youth development, and that means that most youth who offend, even if they're offending seriously right now, are not going to be chronic offenders that are offending for the rest of their life. And most youth's risk level can be changed over time. And those are some very important concepts to keep in mind. Another principle is that many adolescents who come into contact with the law are not going to reoffend even if we do nothing but minimal intervention, because most adolescents are low risk for reoffending. So agencies can divert a lot of youth and still be protecting public safety. So I think one of the last principles that I wanted to mention is that the mere fact that someone is high risk, so first of all, most youth are low risk, but the mere fact that someone is high risk for reoffending doesn't mean that they need to be incarcerated in order to protect public safety. Some high-risk youth can be managed well in the community. High risk simply means that if we do nothing, then this youth is likely to reoffend. But if we do something, we can possibly stop that from happening. Lastly, and this is probably one of Mary Ann's favorites, is
I was going to jump in if you didn't say it.
Oh, yeah. Go ahead. Why don't you say it?
Well, just that I think one of the reasons why we were so eager to have a guide put out is, you know, there is this perception among the legal community that these tools were created to usurp our decision-making and our advocacy. Mm-hmm. And so it was really important for us to include a principle that says that risk assessment tools should inform legal decision-making and offer information, but that they certainly don't replace legal decision-making. And that principle is in the guide. And just to add to that, from the defender's perspective, it also doesn't take the place of our individualized advocacy. So we wanted to make that very clear in the guide.
Terrific. And those guiding principles, I think, also highlight what we've just learned about juvenile justice and youth over the years as well. Are there things you want to add or discuss about risk assessment tools, other sort of common myths or misuse of them, and what research has shown about them?
This is Beth. Perhaps if I just chime in to what and add on to what Mary Ann said regarding, it's interesting because of the concern of counsel and the understanding that they feel that way, but it's interesting that probation officers feel that way, but just from a different angle. One of the myths from the probation officer standpoint is that the use of a risk assessment was discounting their judgment and experience. And early into the training process, and still from time to time, we need to continue to inform them that, you know, judgment alone is important, but it's certainly not nearly as effective as it is with the use of an assessment. So we're not discounting their experience. We're not discounting their judgment. It's not meant to replace any of those things. It's only meant to enhance it. And we've tried to demonstrate that through various articles, that the information that the trainers who initially trained us on this was indeed supported by that, showing that the better outcomes were predicted by the use with the assistance of the use of an instrument. And, you know, a lot of times they felt that administrators were discounting their experience and their judgment. But we also took that one step further, and we said it assists in formalizing their approach, focusing on the areas in the juvenile's life to better match the services to the needs. And so that is an enhancement of their judgment and their experience.
This is Marianne. I'll just jump back on that point is, you know, one of our community myths and fears of risk assessments is that the tools would really rate most of our clients as high. And Gina already explained a bit about that earlier, but that myth of most kids coming out as high risk is one that takes research and education to debunk.
And I just want to add to that, I love that one because we, you know, my colleagues and I at NISAP will go into a probation office or a jurisdiction and start educating them about risk assessment and what factors are actually related to whether or not youth reoffend. And the first thing that we hear from probation officers is, oh, all of our kids are high risk. They're all high risk.
Yep.
You know, in that jurisdiction over there, they don't have high-risk kids, but we have high-risk kids. And that's and once we start educating them about risk, what factors are actually related to risk, and teach them about what that really means and teach them how to use a well-validated risk assessment tool, it completely changes their perception.
Mm-hmm.
And they start looking at youth different on their caseloads differently.
Mm-hmm.
And what then, you know, over time, they've actually got data that indicates that probably about 15%, I would say it lingers to about 15-20% of their youth are going to be high risk. That's it.
Yeah, and actually in Pennsylvania, we've seen pretty much statewide that it's like 7-9%. So it really was an impactful kind of data that we've demonstrated over the past 3 years consistently.
7-9% is
that's
great. That's low.
Mm-hmm.
And another jurisdiction we worked in statewide, it's about 15%.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah.
it does depend a bit, but obviously, I think the point is that it's somebody. And that one other myth that we find, which holds for probably all assessment tools, is that when we go in and we educate people about what a tool is for, they have this idea that there are these one-size-fits-all assessment tools and that an assessment tool is supposed to do everything. Risk assessment tools are designed for one specific purpose, and that is to tell us who's likely to reoffend and who's not, and hopefully to also tell us what is likely driving that youth reoffending. So that's what we refer to as criminogenic needs. That's all a risk assessment tool does. It doesn't tell us if this kid has a mental health problem. It doesn't tell us if this youth has other types of needs that don't relate to reoffending. So, for example, maybe developmental disability of some sort or a learning disability or depression. Those are other needs youth might have, but they don't relate to reoffending. A risk assessment tool isn't going to tell you about those things. It's only designed for one purpose. And I think people often have this perception that an assessment tool is supposed to just document and do everything.
And so can I just say, since Gina used the term criminogenic, that we're, as a community, going to try and find a better term because that's such an awful word to use to children, right, Gina?
That's right. We are. Marianne has been strongly encouraging that we come up with a better term.
Because it always comes up. Children. It comes up as a spell check issue every single time you type it.
And moral and ethical reasons just to get rid of it.
Yes.
Well,
yes.
And criminogenic needs literally means what do you need to be a better criminal? Which is not really what we're doing.
Right.
That's really not what we're doing here. what a criminogenic need is like a dynamic risk factor. It's something that elevates one's likelihood of reoffending, yet it's something that theoretically we can change. So, for example, substance abuse, that will elevate a lot of people's likelihood of reoffending, but we can give them treatment to hopefully deal with that issue. So a criminogenic need is just a risk factor that we can change.
Great.
Yeah.
Well, I know that here in Ohio, a few years ago, we went to try to go to a standardized risk assessment, and, you know, each jurisdiction and even some jurisdictions, depending on the probation officer, had their favorite tool, right? So for those maybe jurisdictions that are using them or not using them right now, what are some considerations for designing or selecting a risk assessment tool?
Do you guys want me to start that one off?
Sure.
Okay. We each have a different perspective of this, and I think when you put all of our ideas together, that's the way to identify the best risk assessment tool. But I'm just going to speak from the risk assessment researcher perspective. We are really trying to influence the use of evidence-based practices. Of course, that's a buzzword in juvenile and criminal justice right now. And the guide is gauged towards evidence-based practice. And so we try to educate people about what is an evidence-based assessment tool. So what kind of evidence does a tool need to have in order for you to have confidence in it? And I'll just cover three of the primary areas here. One is the tool should have some type of manual. It should be manualized so that there's a standardized procedure for administering or conducting the assessment so that everybody's doing it in the same way. And there should be some kind of clear manual. Second, there should be good evidence of reliability. And when I say reliability, I mean if Mary Ann and I were to each take a risk assessment tool and assess Beth at different occasions, we should come up with the same conclusion. So if we both assessed her at low risk, I mean, we should be both assessing her at low risk in order for that tool to be reliable. If you don't have a reliable tool, you might as well just not be using anything. So you need evidence of reliability. And lastly, you need some evidence of validity. And in this context, that means that there's actually evidence, research evidence, that has shown that youth who score higher on the tool are more likely to reoffend than youth who score lower on the tool. And there should be, we recommend that a certain number of studies have been done on the tools before you determine that it's been valid and reliable. And we also recommend that those studies have been conducted by people other than the tool developers who have some kind of interest in, you know, whether the tool is used. And it's very important that you're selecting a tool that was designed for your population and your point in the process. So there's tools that have been validated for use pre-adjudication, post-disposition, you know, with youth who are largely going to go to probation. And then there's other tools that have been designed for use specifically in institutional environments. And those are somewhat different. So that's the kind of evidence that we try to educate people that they should see a tool before they adopt it. Now, I know Beth and Marianne mm-hmm. have some things to add there.
Sure. This is Beth. Just quickly, from a practitioner standpoint, Pennsylvania, we were in a unique situation when we went down this path because we are a Pennsylvania is a county-operated with state oversight system. So there's 67 counties in Pennsylvania, and we don't have a centralized juvenile probation system. So it is county-operated, state oversight, and with that comes interesting challenges for statewide implementation. So the Pennsylvania Council of Chief Juvenile Probation Officers have a strong partnership with the state entity or agency, the Juvenile Court Judges Commission. And for several years, we talked about the desire to have a risk assessment. And in particular, we were looking for ways to be more effective in how we assessed kids for reoffending because we really weren't assessing them in any standardized way and certainly not with a tool, but also how to aid us in our effective case planning process. So with the assistant of Gina, Vincent, and NISAP, she and they explained various tools and instruments that worked most effectively with the delinquent population. So we reviewed a whole bunch of different assessments. And from a chief standpoint, a practitioner standpoint, we absolutely wanted something with solid inter-rater reliability and predictive validity, as Gina just discussed. From a probation officer standpoint, we wanted to make sure that there was ease in administering these, how much time did they take, what was the difficulty for implementing this, how effective this instrument would be in transitioning to a case plan for good service delivery, and, of course, the cost, evaluate the cost that would go into it. So over a period of trainings and meetings with Gina and assessing and continued conference calls, we came up with the decision to use the Youth Level of Service Inventory, which is the YLS.
Mm-hmm.
So this is Marianne, and, you know, typically in a lot of communities, defenders are still not engaged at the front end. We hope through programs like this more defenders will be pulled in as communities are selecting their tool. But from the defender perspective, we're concerned about things like self-incrimination, about tools being used against our clients, about information that might come out of the assessment that would not otherwise be presented to the court or come before the court. And so as we work with our communities of prosecutors and probation officers and judges at the front end, we want to be asking questions about how the tool is envisioned to be used and to be sure that whatever tool is selected does in fact have research to show that it causes and leads to better outcomes for youth and for communities. So I think all of those questions are really good questions a defender could ask.
I just want to add one last piece because none of us got into it, and that is to elaborate on the idea about the tools being designed for specific points in the process. Mm-hmm. And, you know, what Beth and the folks in Pennsylvania wanted was a tool that could be used at probation intake. And any tool that's used with youth who potentially can end up on probation or are going to end up with a disposition of some sort, we highly recommend that that tool should have items in it that are going to help people with their case planning. And I know we're going to talk about case planning a little later in the show today, but that means that there should be some items in the tool that assess the criminogenic need, which is going to be called something else at a later date, but they should be assessing. Maybe some callers can give us some advice about how to change the term criminogenic needs. But we highly recommend that any tool that's being used in probation also have dynamic risk factors included, not just the risk factors that we can't change or do anything about. And, you know, I think that was another point that they were looking for in Pennsylvania when Beth's talking about their selection process.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Yep.
Well, while we're on the potential roles and uses at different points in the process, I'm just wondering if we should stay on that for a minute and discuss it and how what they could reveal and how they can be used in those different stages.
Sure. So this is Gina again. We only touch on this briefly in the guide, the fact that, you know, there's risk assessment. Risk assessment is applicable at various stages within the juvenile justice continuum. However, the most research we have around practices for implementation comes really from the area of probation intake or post-adjudication predisposition and dispositional planning. So there's other areas where tools are used, but we just don't have as much evidence about the best way to do it yet. And so the guide mostly emphasizes, you know, that kind of probation, predisposition, decision point. But risk assessment is also relevant for pretrial types of decisions. So this is something that the Annie Casey Foundation does a lot of, which is help people implement what I would call a risk screening tool to help make decisions about which youth should go to detention while they're awaiting trial, mm-hmm. and which youth are safe to go home. And that's a whole other decision point. And the type of risk tool you're looking for there is something that's very short and sweet. Mm-hmm. It's not going to have typically as great validity because you're getting much less information. And there's just a lot less that you can ask of the kid at that point or the youth or their family because of self-incrimination issues. So that's another decision point where risk assessment or risk screening is applicable, but those are different types of tools. Another area where risk assessment can be used is diversion decisions. And regardless of who's conducting the risk assessment at that point, that's going to vary widely, probably across states. But a tool can be used to help make a decision to just divert the youth away from formal processing completely. And again, there you're looking for short tools that are not going to be getting as much information that might incriminate the youth. Now, Marianne, did you want to add anything there? about concerns about those kinds of tools?
Sure. I mean, you know, if you look at specific items on tools that are used to post adjudication, they do ask questions that are that have some not subjectivity really in scoring, but there is not a clear like score that you get. And you know, we as defenders don't want prosecutors' offices or even probation offices to be asking kids questions about how often they get angry. We really don't like those questions, period, but especially pre-adjudicatory. You can imagine our concern when you look at tools that have a much broader spectrum of information that they're trying to get about a child and then bringing that into any type of decision, whether it's diversion or detention. So we really want to look for very short, brief instruments at those early phases.
Right. And just to add to Marianne's point, you know, we know from the risk assessment literature and just delinquency trajectories in general that some items that are really predictive of what a youth is going to do is how old they were when they committed their first violent act, how frequently they've been violent, how much different kinds of how much trouble they've gotten into in different types of settings in their lives. And these are really this is really important information to get to accurately evaluate a kid's risk level and also determine what's, you know, probably the best course of treatment for this youth. But when you start asking youth those kinds of questions, pre-adjudicatory, they may be admitting to stuff, to a lot of things that they were never caught for, and opening up a whole can of worms. So we just don't recommend those kinds of assessments at those stages. Substance abuse is another big risk factor when we're dealing with youth. And if you're asking youth about their substance abuse practices when they've never gotten in trouble for smoking marijuana, for example, then, again, they could be incriminating themselves.
Right. This is Beth. If I could just add one point to some of the things I heard, I think it's really important to make sure that I think these were that was a really good question that Gina started with answering, because if agencies or practitioners don't understand the difference between the screening and an assessment tool, where it's utilized at what decision-making point and what the intended purpose is in, is I get very concerned when I hear those things, because I have heard folks assume Pennsylvania is also using the detention instrument, but that is an instrument used, as Gina said, to make a decision for a snapshot point in time of whether or not that youth should be given an alternative to detention or detained to assure that they'll appear for court, or if they're really a serious risk for some dangerous activity while they're still in the community. And the reality is, if I have heard some folks just assume, well, we're using a detention instrument, so I don't need to use any other kind of assessment tool for case planning. And that is very dangerous. One, it's totally intended for something different, and two, it really is not to guide you into the case planning process. So it's real important for people to be understand and educated in the difference.
Yeah, that is an excellent point. I think that is – I'm really glad Beth brought that up, because I think – there is a concern here just about educating the users of these tools about what the tool was really intended to do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
and where should it be used and where shouldn't it be used. And another issue is how long range,
mm-hmm.
how long do these predictions actually hold? Those detention tools
mm-hmm.
are for a very short period of time. It's the time between
right.
arraignment and trial.
Mm-hmm.
And high risk on one of those tools doesn't mean the same thing as high risk on, you know, an assessment like the YLS that they're doing in Pennsylvania,
right.
which is for longer range planning.
That's right.
Yeah.
I'd like to remind our callers, if they'd like to ask a question to our guests live on air, to dial 347-994-1149 and press the number 1 on your telephone keypad, as well as you can use our chat room to submit some questions there. So, Beth, I'd like to turn to you for a moment. You're on the ground.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe you can sort of share what it was like for your community to select and implement a risk assessment tool? I know you've also been very active on a state level, but you know, what led to the decision, oh, we need to use one, and what have been some of the lessons learned and outcomes?
Okay, great. Thanks. I'll try my hardest to be brief because I'm going to try to tell you it from a county perspective, but also a state perspective, because much like we rolled it out at a state level, we're trying to model that at a state level with how we're hoping counties implement it at their county level. So as I indicated, Lehigh is one of 65 of the 67 counties in Pennsylvania implementing the YLS, and we've been, after making that decision in April 2009, we did our first training of master trainers, and we started out with 10 counties involved. We have 65 counties, and we have about 175 master trainers now. But our system is in a major state of what we call an enhancement, and really what that is movement towards employing evidence-based practices at every stage of our system. And, of course, this is really important because, again, the YLS is not just a document you do that you just put into the drawer. So when you're, you know, embarking down this path, you want to make sure that people understand that this is the cornerstone, really, of what will help drive your practices within your department. So after the Juvenile Court Judges Commission and the Chiefs Council made this decision, we decided to show our efforts behind this by developing an ad hoc committee at the state level, identified master trainers. As I said, we now have 175. One of the things that we did, however, is we wanted these master trainers to return back to their communities, and part of their next step was to develop a committee. That committee would be of stakeholders, and we'll talk about this at a few other points on this show, but not only training their departments on how to complete the instrument, but on encouraging this committee of stakeholders, prosecutors, defenders, judges or masters, probation reps, school reps, to understand the purpose of why this is for not only the buy-in, but if you really implement it the manner in which it's supposed to be implemented, it will absolutely create operational changes within your organization. So you really need them at the table, these folks at the table, so they understand why this is. The committee is important also in the assistance of policies that need to be developed and procedures and practices. In assuring quality assurance, the committee can continue to provide oversight. Really, the committee becomes the foundation of driving this whole initiative forward. The committees we encourage to get involved in gathering data for evaluation purposes and so forth. So this statewide initiative, we continue 3 years into it to have quarterly booster calls with all the counties to support their activities, including policy development, including training, booster trainings, quality assurance, and data. And then within each county throughout the state, those very same activities are occurring. A couple other points before I go into the challenges. We really strongly encourage booster trainings. So every 6 months we're asking counties, if not more frequently, to do booster trainings. So we've standardized our booster case practice. We develop 3 cases. Every few months we send them out. They're scored. Case histories are right there so that we know we have a consistent structured booster training that is occurring throughout the state. I think one of the challenges is, despite the success in Pennsylvania, is the need for constant messaging on this important topic of why this is needed, of reassuring others that their experience is still vitally important in this process, and that the YLS is much more than just a document. So there's not a day that goes by throughout the state of Pennsylvania and every county where the YLS isn't driving a lot of the activities within the department. We continue to help educate stakeholders because of the use. We're training them on the delinquency risk factors. It helps to determine appropriate levels of supervision, helps establish measurable case-specific goals, and really necessary resources for better outcomes. What this has also done is taught our staff about not over-servicing our youth, certainly avoiding further penetration into the system for our low-risk youth. It's changed operational ways that the counties are dealing with their low-risk youth. And I think one of the other things regarding implementation, and again, I'm really I'm cutting this short. I could talk an hour on just this subject, but one of the things that I think many of the counties could have done a better job on early on was the inclusion of defense counsel and prosecutors. So we did include them in discussions, but several counties did not include them on their initial committee work. And in retrospect, looking back, we brought them on, you know, partially down the path, and it just took some additional time to get them up to speed in the depth that they really deserve to be up to speed. And additionally, we found that by arranging a special training just for council, it could really help drive the practice forward in a much more expedited way after we did the training specifically for them. So I'll pause there and let my colleagues add to that.
So I just wanted to jump in and just ask Beth, so it's clear to the callers and listeners, what were the challenges that the communities faced that didn't engage the defenders and judges and lawyers up front? What happened as a result of not engaging them? Because I think that experience is important.
I think that there was a lack of clear understanding. So our debate was, well, how much do they really need to know? They don't need to know how to do a YLS. So initially folks were thinking, well, then they don't really need to be at the table because this is all about training. But as we tried to instill upon the counties, this is so much more than just a training. There are so many, because eventually you're going to be coming into court, you're going to be talking about this language.
Right.
Those folks need to be there to understand. They may not need to know how to do the instrument, but they need to know about the science, the research behind it, and how this will be applicable to their clients,
right.
what it is intended to do and not do. And so we had to circle back, and now we have these counsel and defenders on our committees, which has just helped really help support and drive this moving forward much, much more smoother.
And then just to underscore that, this is Marianne, you know, in terms of the implementation of a tool in a jurisdiction, you can imagine, you know, a bunch of lawyers who don't have information and how they respond.
Exactly.
Because we want to know what this information is that you're using about our clients.
That's right.
And or that you're suggesting that I make decisions based on.
That's
or
right.
Advocacy based on.
That's right.
So
that's right.
We know from working with our defenders and communities that it's critical to engage them, educate them, answer their questions, help them understand what the process is, and listen to their suggestions.
Absolutely. And probation officers shouldn't be intimidated or threatened by that, because what we've seen, the experience has been, it's helped us much more than by excluding them.
Exactly. Yes. And so we just hope to see that in more communities across the country as these
mm-hmm.
tools continue to be implemented.
I think I would just
go
ahead.
No, go on. That's what I was going to
okay.
ask you.
I think I would just add to that, Beth and what they've done in Pennsylvania is an excellent model for implementation, because they have just covered the gamut of, you know, all of the steps that we would say are important in getting a risk assessment system. They really have a risk assessment system.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it's not just a risk assessment tool, it's a system. Yet one of the other challenges which tags on to the defender knowledge being given to the defenders about these tools is the judges. And we have seen in some jurisdictions or counties that if the judges weren't kind of brought in to the selection of the tool in the beginning, or educated about the tool and what it's supposed to do, and basically if you haven't had the judges buy-in, that
mm-hmm.
can really stymie any changes occurring from putting a risk
right.
assessment tool in place. So especially if you've got a jurisdiction where the judges are used to making all the decisions without recommendations from probation officers and without some kind of predisposition report, where the judges kind of make all the decisions about services the youth should get while they're on probation, as well as the disposition, and they also make decisions about supervision level. If the judges are used to doing that without any information, without considering any information from a risk assessment tool, and they continue to operate that way, then, you know, what the judge says goes. So the probation officer doesn't have any flexibility in changing a case
right.
plan
right.
after the fact.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, if you don't have the judge's buy-in from the beginning, it's just as important as having the attorney's buy-in from the beginning
yeah.
that
yeah.
things just may not even happen. And we have
yeah.
seen some places where that goes.
Yeah.
It goes that way.
I'm sorry. Yeah, this is Beth.
No, go ahead.
And that is absolutely critical, just as critical as counsel, because the bottom line is we can do all this training of our staff who then prepare case plans and they go before the judge. And if they're not – listen, we all know that misinformation or lack of information, it can be extremely detrimental. And when we're talking about youth's lives, everybody needs to be educated. But the balancing act is judges are very busy. So how much do you give them versus, you know, excluding them? So that's that constant balancing act. But just to support what Gina said, the best thing you can do is get as many people to the table as possible and keep the judges as informed, even if they're not at the table for these committee meetings.
Right. Absolutely.
And Marianne, you've already shared some thoughts from a defender, children's attorney's perspective about the use and what's important for attorneys to know. Is there anything else you want to talk about why this is important and considerations?
You know, I think I've shared a lot, Lauren, about what I think defenders want to be asking, but I also want to just underscore that because a tool is implemented in a jurisdiction doesn't mean that a defender's job is done. It means just the opposite. You know, we have an ethical duty to represent the individualized interests of our young clients, and that we play a critical role in terms of affording checks and balances on how a risk assessment tool is used in a jurisdiction. So if the defender never cross-examines a probation officer or never asks any questions about a tool or never demands to see the score or how it's used, I think what happens is it doesn't provide that check on implementation that is otherwise necessary for an effective use of a risk assessment tool. So just to say that our individualized work in no way ends because a tool is implemented. In fact, we are required to understand the tool so well that we can cross-examine, ask questions, and ensure that it's being used correctly and that it doesn't undermine our, you know, stated interest advocacy for our clients.
Yes. Marianne, just I think maybe it's a good point. I think you'd want me to add in what we did in Pennsylvania regarding our share information sharing and self-incrimination. This is Beth again. And so in October of 2008, our governor signed into law Act 109. So Act 109 of 2008 basically amends our Juvenile Act. And this provides that no statements, admissions, or confessions can be made by a child in the course of a screening or assessment in conjunction with a proceeding that can be admitted into evidence. So this is really a critical step in allowing our system basically to utilize evidence-based screening and assessment instruments as part of our operations that is acceptable to defense counsel so that it is not used against them. You know, we can give some information during disposition, but as it pertains to any proceeding related to a delinquent act, it's not admissible as evidence.
Yeah, and putting those policies in place that we just think is essential in terms of implementation. So you've got
Absolutely.
To sit together and talk about.
That's right.
You know, what are the protections that are going to be put in place and ensuring that still the community recognizes and wants to afford due process protections to children and not just have these informal, let's talk about everything that we learned, conversations
right.
about kids in court.
This is Gina. I just wanted to add to what Marianne and Beth are saying that the legislation in Pennsylvania was outstanding with respect to protecting that information. And there are a couple of other states that have similar legislation in place. I believe Illinois is one of them. And we included in the appendices in the guide the actual acts that these folks put in place in case other states want to adopt something similar.
Well, we
have, so it's all there.
Have about 10 minutes left. And we did have a question, which I think kind of rolls into this larger question about policies and practices that should be in place to support successful use of risk assessment tools, which you've already been talking about. The specific question was on qualifications of people who are allowed to use a tool in addition to receiving the proper training. So any thoughts or recommendations you have around that as well?
Gina, do you want to start with that?
Okay.
Do you want to start?
Sure, I'll start. Yeah, that's a great question. One of the policies that we recommend people put in place when they're adopting a risk assessment tool is a policy that basically outlines the requirements, the training requirements, and who is going to be conducting those risk assessments, how often they're going to be conducting them, what type of information they should be gathering to conduct the risk assessment, and so on and so forth. So there's basically some quality control and some standardized procedures outlined in folks' policies. And that is going to vary, of course, based on the kind of risk assessment tool adopted, where in the system it's been adopted, and so forth. But since we're mostly talking about probation officers doing these assessments here, I'll focus on that. Essentially, you know, the risk assessment tools that we recommend for use on probation, we generally require a 1 or 2 day workshop to know how to complete the assessment tool, and there'll be a number of practice cases that people complete during that time. And hopefully they'll need to have demonstrated a certain level of competence by the end of that training. And then we also recommend, and they did this in Pennsylvania, they did it in Louisiana, some other states that we've worked with, we also recommend that post-training, post that two-day workshop, people do a series of other standardized case vignettes where they have, you know, a written case and they complete an assessment on it, be it the SAVORY, the YLS, the YASI, whatever the tool is that they've adopted, and they score the tool and have it checked by an expert or a master trainer of some sort. And they should do like 2 or 3 additional practice cases post-training. And then they generally have, at that point, hopefully achieved the competency, the level of competency needed to go ahead and do these assessments on their own. For folks who haven't achieved the level of competency, we suggest that master trainers give them some feedback and maybe supervise their assessments for a short while. And then we also strongly recommend that everybody get booster training every 6 months. And that is, you know, they just go out and do some kind of practice case and show that their scoring is still up to par. Some states have actually, Alaska, for example, is a great example of this. They've actually put training videos, I think, online so that their staff are doing booster trainings online and having to submit their scoring and somebody checks it. It's very well done. So a system like that can be put in place, too. I don't know, Beth, did you want to add anything?
If I can, please. We followed very similar process that Gina just talked about, but really I can't emphasize this enough because in my mind there's nothing more dangerous than doing a YLS incorrectly and making decisions about how to process a case based on incorrect information. So after the initial master trainers are trained, we make sure that we continue to send standardized booster cases out to them every several months, case studies scored, and then everybody consistently is utilizing that within their own jurisdictions and their own counties when they do their own individual training. In addition, we have yearly been involved in doing master trainers recertification. Now, we've just bumped that up to every 2 years because we have a very solid booster training for our master trainers based on these booster cases we send around. But within each county, I just wanted to chat about that for 1 second, and that is the master trainers that are then coming back to their individual jurisdictions are doing the very same thing with these booster trainings. And some are doing trainings in a large forum at a staff meeting. Some are doing it within unit meetings. Some are just reminding folks periodically about definitions. But at least every 6 months, they are also doing these booster cases. In addition, we track the scores of those cases so we can really identify if somebody's having any particular problems. The other thing, if we have a few moments to talk shortly about outcomes and reports and data that we're collecting, some of the administrative reports that we're collecting are helping us reflect on some of the staff that may need some additional assistance in doing these in doing the YLS. So really, really critically important to make sure that there's policies and practices in place to address ongoing quality assurance and iterator reliability issues.
And this is Mary, and I'll just jump in at the end and say, even though it's not the defender who's being trained, it's important for them to know what the qualifications are so that they can also, again, provide that check and balance and be sure that the people in the community who are administering the tool again, they can ask questions, whether it's on the stand or off the stand, about the qualifications of those people who are administering the tools.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, we really are at final thoughts. So I would say, I knew, right? There's so much to talk about, and maybe we'll need to do a follow-up show. But I want to make sure you share anything that you really wanted to convey that you haven't had the opportunity to, and any sort of final considerations you want to share with listeners about risk assessments.
Okay. Go ahead, Gina.
If I could just add one point, because we haven't gotten to talk about this at all, and I wouldn't want us to leave the show without mentioning it, is that it's just so important, again, when you're talking about using risk assessment for case planning, mm-hmm. it's so important to think about this as a risk assessment system and not just a risk assessment tool, and have a structured case plan that is used in conjunction with that risk assessment tool. That is really key, so that probation officers are trained how to select services for youth or interventions for youth that are going to meet the needs that are actually identified on the assessment tool. Yeah. And that is a piece that is discussed at length, I think, in the guide. And, you know, it's I can't emphasize it enough.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is Beth. Gina, are you finished with that comment? Before
I'm
you
done.
Know I'm talking
I'm done,
about
sorry.
Case planning. No.
Talk over.
No. Case planning. I'm just supporting what Gina said regarding that. If people go into this thinking that they're just doing a document, they're going to miss the very intended purposes and the critical importance of ongoing training at the same time regarding the ability to match services and do it in an effective case plan, that this is much more than just compliance of conditions of supervision, and there's a whole system involved here. And the only other thing that I would say, and also just a piece about data and the outcome tracking, because it can really change your operations within your department, so really develop some kind of solid case management system, structured case plan, and then pull the data from that to help drive your operational changes. And the only other thing I'll say is continue to have faith, because there's going to be moments where it is extremely challenging, and then one day the light bulb goes on for somebody and you walk by and you hear some great conversations and everyone's talking the same language and they're challenging each other, and then you know that it was well worth the challenges.
This is Mary, and I'll just jump in to say to the defender community and to the other stakeholder groups, you know, please engage defenders in these processes. I think it's critically important for them to be well-educated, for them to ask questions about manualized tools and inter-reader reliability and validity. Like, we shouldn't be afraid of those words. We should be able to, you know, educate ourselves about risk tools in the same way we educate ourselves about forensic evidence, and that we can engage with these tools in a way that we can still provide express interest representation. You know, we work with our clients to talk to them about an individualized disposition plan, and know that the probation plan is going to come in recommending some case planning that doesn't have to be in conflict with what your client wants and needs.
Great. And it sounds like we may need to do, honestly, a whole show on case planning. If you're all willing to be on that as a follow-up, that would be great.
That would be all Beth.
No. Sorry for interrupting you, but you know that I feel so strongly about that.
We can talk about that later.
Individualized case plan too.
Yeah.
I highly encourage all our listeners to look at the publication and download it called Risk Assessment in Juvenile Justice, a guidebook for implementation. And that can be found on Children's Law's website as well as on the Models for Change MacArthur Foundation's website, which is modelsforchange.net under publications. I want to thank you, Mary Ann, Gina, and Beth, again for being here. It's been really wonderful.
Thanks so much for having us, Lauren.
Thank you for having us, Lauren.
Our next show will examine juvenile justice in a human rights framework, comparing what's happening in the United States to other countries. So, and if you have ideas for future shows, you can email them to me, Lauren, at childrenslaw@ispconsults.com. To stay informed about upcoming shows, you can either follow us here at Blog Talk Radio or visit the Children's Law Center's website at www.childrenslawky.org. Take care and see you next time on Spotlight on Youth. Thanks again, everybody.
Okay. Thanks.
Thank you.